Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the first of Stakeholder Forum's countdown to the UN SDG Summit 2023, series of eight webinars in the run-up to the September 2023 SDG Summit. With the support of experts in each of the first 16 SDGs, we aim to review two goals each month from now until June 2023. In the run-up to the July 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development. The series will explore where we are in their implementation and identify transformative actions for change. This event has been organized by Stakeholder Forum for a Sustainable Future in connection with our proposed 2023 platform, an instrument to support more effective monitoring and review of the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, during the 2023 United Nations High-Level Political Forum on Sustainable Development Review Cycle. I'm Charles Nuhan, Chairman of Stakeholder Forum, and your host today from New York. I'm joined today by today's moderator, Dr. David Horan, Assistant Professor at Trinity Business School, Trinity College Dublin, and advisor to SDG Partnerships and Governance for the SDGs for Stakeholder Forum. David joins us today from Ireland. As you can see on your screen, we have a panel of special guests who, with a diverse range of experiences and knowledge, will be introduced by David in the coming minutes. For those of you unfamiliar with Stakeholder Forum, it is an international, not-for-profit NGO that has, for more than 25 years, been working to advance sustainable development at all levels. The Stakeholder Forum seeks to provide a bridge between those who have a stake in sustainable development and the international forums where decisions are made in their name. Now, before we move on to our program, there is a bit of housekeeping to attend to. Please note that the webinar is being live streamed on YouTube, and a link to the recording will be posted on the Stakeholder Forum website soon afterward. As you will also see, the attendee cameras and microphones are muted and will remain so throughout the webinar. However, there will be an opportunity for questions from attendees near the end of the experts' roundtable discussion, and those questions should be submitted in the Q&A section at the bottom of your screen, not in the chat section. The chat section is for you to communicate with each other, where you can post links to matters relevant to this webinar topic, and of course also share contact details with each other if you wish to. You are welcome to scroll through the questions and upvote the questions. That is, if you see a question that you too would like to be addressed, that will help us see that there's momentum behind a particular question or two, and it will give our panel an opportunity to answer in the time that we have. I'll also say apologies in advance for not being able to answer all questions due to the time constraints. Now, let's begin today with introductory comments. We have them from Dr. Frederick Sautau, Jamil Ahmad, and Jan-Gustav Strandenes. Dr. Sautau is chief of the Intergovernmental Policy and Review Branch of the Office of Intergovernmental Support and Coordination for Sustainable Development at UNDESA. Jamil Ahmad is the director of Intergovernmental Affairs at the United Nations Environment Program in New York, and Jan-Gustav Strandenes is Senior Advisor on Governance at Stakeholder Forum. Fred, you are our first speaker. Please activate your microphone and the camera, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Charles. Thank you for that kind introduction. At the moment, it says I can't activate my camera because the host has stopped it. But maybe I'll just kick off.
Let me do that. I'll get you going right now. So you go ahead and continue. I'll get your camera going.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, as I said, for the kind introduction. Very pleased to join all of you this morning, this afternoon, as Charles is joining you also here from New York, and working in the Secretariat for the HLPF and also for the SDG Summit. So I was asked just to say a few words about that process and about stakeholder engagement. And let me say how wonderful it is that Stakeholder Forum is engaging in this review. And of course, also reviewing all the SDGs, because sometimes we find, of course, a selection of SDGs being reviewed. And it's really great to have a comprehensive review in the run-up to the summit, and also looking at the interlinkages between the SDGs, again, something which sometimes is neglected. Of course, we find ourselves now at a point soon in the run-up to the summit, the midpoint of the SDGs. And as the concept note for this event, this webinar has outlined quite a few setbacks. You know, we know that with the effects of the pandemic and other crises, the first time that the Human Development Index has been set back, some of the progress on poverty is rolled back. But of course, we also know that progress overall on the SDGs was lagging well before the pandemic. So we can't pin all of the problems on the pandemic, but nonetheless, a difficult time. So in the run-up to the summit, what we're looking for, in one sense, is, of course, an honest review. So in that sense, this process of webinars contributes that honest, clear-eyed review of where we stand, of a stock-taking, but also as we look forward, an attempt to say, how can we move forward towards transformation? How can we rekindle and reinvigorate that promise and that excitement that we had around the SDGs and the agenda, so that doesn't get lost? So that some of the sense of perhaps of setback doesn't lead to despondency, but instead does lead us to move forward. And the preparations for the summit have started many different tracks. I would call it one of those tracks, the tracks from civil society. We're working with the private sector. We're working with local governments. So trying to interest and energize as many communities as possible to do the kind of work that's being done in this webinar, to look at where we are and what we can do to really accelerate the SDGs going forward. And within the United Nations, one of the first major milestones coming up will, of course, be the July HLPF. And in many ways, that's being seen, including by the president of ECOSOC, Ambassador Stoyeva of Bulgaria, who convenes the HLPF as a form of a pre-summit, as a very important way station and sort of point on the way to the summit, a time to really take stock, to begin to feed ideas into the process as we head for the summit. So before that too, as you probably know, the regional commissions of the United Nations in the five regions will be convening the regional sustainable development forums. Those are also at the regional level an opportunity to identify priorities, to take stock, and also working closely with civil society. Each of those mechanisms, especially in Asia and also in Africa, have a very strong civil society mechanism. So really bringing in that perspective from the regional level. And I want to just say in closing, really what we're looking for, and I think hope we can identify, is both an honest review, but it shouldn't let us sit back or lead to a feeling of inability to progress. We really want to look and honestly, but also find those examples of progress, of transformation even. And I think even in the goals where there's less that really look more difficult, it's on us and all of us to try and find those examples. So one idea will be also working at the national level, so that we ask national governments and their leaders when they come to the summit to come forward with examples of transformative policies, to come forward with the kind of plans they're putting in place to close the SDG gap by 2030. So not a sort of Pollyanna look at the future, but a realistic attempt, but also realizing we have to go move forward, and also delving into each goal. And I hope we can do this in this webinar and future webinars to find those examples where there has been progress, because they are there. And they, of course, if we find them, we need to scale them up. We need to identify the sort of enabling forces that we need for that progress, whether it's finance, whether it's capacity building, whether it's modifications to our trade regime, whether it's discussions around the financial architecture, whether it's discussions more difficult also about the enabling environment at the national level, things we don't always discuss, such as governance, the rule of law, what is needed to drive progress. So with that, I'll close my remarks and wish you well in this webinar, and look forward to the outcomes of this webinar and the future reviews. Thank you.
Fred, thank you so much. And also especially thank you for reminding us that there has been progress and that there is certainly a lot of hope still to be had. With that, I'll ask our next speaker. Mr. Ahmad, if you could please activate your microphone. There you are, and your camera. Perfect. And you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Charles, and a very good morning and good afternoon and good evening to all participants who are joining us from all over the world. And thank you, the Stakeholder Forum, for giving UNEP this opportunity to be part of this very useful discussion ahead of the 2023 Summit on SDGs. We know we are now reaching the midpoint, and we always mentioned in general terms that the links about the SDGs and how they are all inextricably interlinked with each other, and one SDG, if it is successful, it will have a salutary effect on the other. And if one is lagging behind, others will also be pulled down. So that interlinkage is well known. That was part of the idea of bringing the 2030 agenda to the table when it was adopted in 2015. But since then, these interlinkages have become more pronounced, as was mentioned by the previous colleague, Frederick. We now have to, we now have to work ahead and see how these interlinkages can be leveraged to the success of SDGs and implementing them in a more positive way. UNEP is doing some enabling work for this, and that one of that is the Measuring Progress series, which focuses on the on analyzing the environmental dimension of SDGs by presenting the progress made in terms of data availability and their environment and their environmental improvement or degradation on the one hand, and on the other, the exploration of statistical analysis that identify these interlinkages at the indicator level among the three dimensions of SDGs. So the third edition of the Measuring Progress is being developed. It will use a multivariate analysis to understand the relationship between freshwater and marine-related ecosystems, drivers, pressures, and responses, and socioeconomic and environmental factors with which they are related to and are influenced by. So please note that this report is currently under peer review and has not been finalized as yet. On a second related aspect of these interlinkages, UNEP is working, or UNEP is observing the data availability for the environment-related SDGs. 41%, and this is a large number, 41% of the 92 environment-related SDG indicators still lack data or have insufficient data to analyze. So this is something that is a bit of concern. But on the other hand, 38% show positive change, indicating environmental improvement. And another 21% of SDG environment-related indicators are showing negative or little change. This trend does not identify progress towards achieving the targets of 2030. Instead, it only indicates where, based on data availability, the indicator is moving towards environmental improvement or degradation. On SDG 1 specifically, the statistical analysis has indicated a relationship between SDG 1.1.1, which relates to employed population below international poverty line, and fresh water related ecosystems, which is SDG 6.6.1. This relationship implies that the more fresh water is available, like bigger water bodies, the lower the percentage of employed population below international poverty line, as water sector has great potential to employ people, and people's health is less impacted by the unavailability of water. Right, on SDG 2, the analysis has indicated a relationship between SDG 2.1.1 on the relevance of undernourishment, proportion of children moderately or severely stunted, and SDG 6.6.1, again on the freshwater related ecosystems. These relationships imply that an increase in the freshwater body extent might lead to a decrease in both the prevalence and undernourishment and the proportion of children stunted. The point of highlighting these two examples was that there are more and more links between the indicators and the targets of SDGs, which our Measuring Progress series will focus on in the coming months. And the objective is to have a realistic stock take ahead of the 2023 summit. In that sense, I think we are working very closely again with stakeholders and other civil society and governments to see how we can expedite this process and help create an enabling environment, as was mentioned by my previous colleague, by at the national level also for implementation of and achieving SDGs. I'll thank you.
Mr. Ahmad, thank you ever so much. And in particular, it's important to emphasize the importance of UNEP's engagement here. We have the SDG summit coming up in 2023, but of course the next United Nations, the UNEA, the Environment Assembly, isn't going to be until 2024. And as a result, there may not normally be an opportunity for the environmental component of all the SDGs to be focused in the same way. So part of this platform 2023 is to include that, a very important element. Now, just one thing before Jan Gustav starts, to say to our guests who've joined us a bit late, if you have questions, please put them in the Q&A section rather than the chat section. We will be sharing the chat section with everybody, but it would be easier for us if we had the questions in the Q&A area, because our speakers will be able to look at them and, of course, answer them as time is allowed. Jan Gustav, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Charles, and thank you for introducing me. And as I said before, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We are about 1 month from sending the year 2022 to the annals of history. It has been a significant year, and it has been a remarkable year. It's been significant because it was the year when we were finally going to open up, have in-person meetings and negotiations and reset development after the drama of COVID. We were all going to build back better and plan forward in improved ways. 2022 has been a remarkable year also because the world was thrown into a war by the unprovoked attack by Russia on Ukraine, a war which many nations claim to be a regional inter-European war, but which is also a war where despotic and authoritarian state has chosen to wage war against democratic values, freedom of speech, and values of liberty, freedom, and justice. Good governance is at peril everywhere in such circumstances. 2022 has been a remarkable year because it was the year we could celebrate 50 years of concerted, consistent, and continued work to safeguard the environment, the environmental stability and well-being of the planet. It was 50 years since the UN Environment Programme was founded. 2022 is also a remarkable year because it was the year we could, the principle of loss and damages in the context of global warming and climate change was agreed to at COP27. But 2022 was also a remarkable year because countries almost reneged on the 1.5 degree target agreed to in Paris in 2015 and emphasized in Glasgow almost exactly a year ago. 2022 can be a remarkable and significant year if the upcoming COP on biodiversity in Canada in December can deliver a decisively positive outcome and halt the loss of biodiversity. 2022 can be a remarkable year and a significant one if we by now start preparing for a successful and promising SDG summit in September next year. Today, as Charles said, is the first of a series of 8 monthly webinars we will organize, preparing and advocating for the summit. Each will deal with 2 SDGs. Each will look at what is unique about the 2030 Agenda and the SDGs, that they are indivisible, interlinked, and integrated, that they are people-centered, planet-sensitive, and universal, that they incorporate the 3 dimensions of sustainable development, the economic, social, and environmental reality. The purpose of the webinar series is to determine where we are in the process of implementing the SDGs, identify transformative actions for change, assess what kind of disruptions they might create together, look for alliances they might suggest, all to accelerate progress. Bringing together a wide range of experts, policymakers, and practitioners with knowledge and insights on integrated approaches, with understanding of the interlinkages within the SDGs, we seek to establish a community of practice and experience. We must ask a set of critical questions. Are we falling behind the schedule to save the world? If so, what needs to be done? Do we understand obstacles? Can we replicate progress? Can we strengthen good partnership and dissolve poor ones? Do we need to reset the 2030 agenda? And if so, how? A few weeks ago, I attended a high-level conference organized by the UN Office of Sustainable Development called the SDG Transformation Forum. A great many delegates emphasized the necessity to manage expectations with the upcoming SDG summit. 2 weeks earlier, I had been speaking to a seasoned delegate about the upcoming summit next year, referring to the outcome declaration from the 2019 SDG summit. He claimed that it was filled with self-evident statements, lofty clichés at worst, aspirational promises at best. Friends, we know what to do, how to do it, and we have the money to set this planet on the right course. Getting it done is a matter of politics, a matter of priorities and values. If we do not set high and auspicious goals and map out possible ways to implement these, what is then going to encourage us to go the extra mile? Yes, this 2019 summit declaration was ambitious. Yes, the decade of action is ambitious. And we need to be better than those. If we now start to manage expectations and are fearful of being overambitious, we will have relegated the 2030 summit to failure. We cannot manage expectations. They need and are supposed to be high. Those who judge content, claiming it is riddled with cliches, are creating explanations for them not to be disappointed. The 2030 agenda is precisely the answer to the post-COVID credo, building back better. It is about transformative change. It is about planning forward. Leaving no one behind is no cliche. Completing the 2030 agenda is not too ambitious. We cannot manage and modify expectations of an ambitious realizations of the five P's: people, planet, partnership, prosperity, and peace. Creating a momentum for the upcoming summit next September, which will be ambitious, hopeful, and successful, is also why we organize these monthly webinars. 2022 was a remarkable year because we continued to believe in the full realization of the 2030 agenda. 2023 will be a significant year if we can agree at the summit to intensify and implement the acceleration of the 2030 agenda with the SDGs. I thank you for your attention.
Yeah, Gustav, thank you very much, and in particular, for identifying a roadmap that we all need in order to bring the 2030 agenda to a degree of realization. Now, with that, I would like to hand the floor over to our moderator, Dr. David Horn. David, if you'd please activate your mic. And I'd also like to ask, David, do you have a couple of comments you want to make first, or should we bring everyone in the gallery mode? What would you recommend?
I have a few introductory comments, but it may be good to invite everyone in.
Very good. Well, all of our guests, we have Dr. Baccarara is with us. All of our speakers are with us. So if you don't mind all activating your microphones and your cameras, and we'll go into gallery view. And David will have his initial comments, and then we'll begin. Deb, very good to see you. Thank you for joining us. David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Charles, for your introduction and to the speakers for their valuable introductory comments. On behalf of Stakeholder Forum, I'd like to welcome everyone to our discussion on SDGs 1 and 2. It is great to have you all here. I think you're in for a real treat. We have five excellent speakers for the discussion. First, each speaker will discuss their recommendations for accelerating the implementation of SDGs 1 and 2 and ways to enable integrated approaches. We will then take questions from the audience. Please feel free to post your questions in the Q&A box, and I will do my utmost to get around to them in the limited time that we have. Before we hear from the speakers, I will first introduce them to everyone. First, you will hear from Dr. Deb Bhattacharya, who is a renowned macroeconomist and public policy analyst and distinguished fellow at the Center for Policy Dialogue in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Our second speaker is the highly esteemed Chantaline Carpentier, who serves as chief of the UN Conference on Trade and Development in the New York Office of the Secretary General. Third, we are delighted to have with us Yunus Ajambo, who is an economist and development coordination officer at the UN Resident Coordinator's Office in Namibia. Fourth, we are very happy to introduce leading researcher, Dr. Danielle Malerba, senior researcher for the program Transformation of Economic and Social Systems, the German Institute for the Development and Sustainability. To finish off, we will hear from a leader in her field, Hannah El-Hilali, chairman at Aspire Capital Holding Company and executive director at Al-Khair Microfinance Company. So we are very grateful to have you all here, and we look forward to your contributions. So I would like now to give the floor to Dr. Deb Bhattacharya. Deb, given your vast experience, including as a member of the UN Committee for Development Policy, founding chair of the Southern Voice Network of think tanks, convener of the Citizens Platform for SDGs in Bangladesh, as well as many other esteemed positions, we would be grateful for your recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Horan, for the introduction. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all the colleagues who have joined here today from all over the world. I do appreciate this opportunity to connecting with you, and particularly having the opportunity to share with you some of the thoughts regarding SDG 1 in the new context or the current context, and what are the prospects or what is the expectations for the high-level political forum or the SDG review for 2023. So my first point would be very simple, is that how do we redraw the context or the new benchmark which is necessary? Without this proper new appraisal of the benchmark, we will be not in a position to refashion ourselves in the new context. And the new benchmark is underpinned by the interrupted post-COVID recovery in 2022. This is number one. The number two is obviously the global commodity prices are going up, and also the services cost, particularly the maritime cost, which leads us to point out that the supply chain disruptions are still out there, and which is related to the war going on in Ukraine and the sanctions which have been imposed, which are also having spillover impacts on the commodity markets and the inflation situation in many countries of the world, and in particular in the developing countries, which are dependent on the fuel import and the food import. The third issue which one needs to take into account is the looming global recession. So 2023 promises to be unfortunately not better than 2022 under the current projections, and all the international organizations have been downgrading their projections every other quarter. So that's the new context. I think there is, for 2023, a new assessment of the context is important. On the issue of SDG 1, regarding the focus area and the policy experience we have, I think what is important to note that three major changes we observe based on our studies, which we have done on the impact of COVID on the poverty situation. The first observation, general observation across developing countries, is that the share of people under the general poverty line, the overall general poverty line, however, is measured whether by the national poverty lines or the global 1.8 or plus a dollar per capita that share has grown. So the average share which we have in different studies is around 10%. But this is that is the first observation. Then the second observation is that in terms of the hardcore poor, the share of share has grown much more than the general share in that way. That the hardcore poor have the growth maybe starting from 15% to 20% more, while the general poor people may have grown 10%. The third issue is that it is not only the left behind people, the traditionally LNOBs. We now have the PNOBs, we call push behind peoples. So the push behind peoples are the new poor. So these are the new poor we are talking about, and they have to be taken note of, which the SDG may not have thought of. SDG thought of exponentially going to reducing the number, share of number and share of poor people. They never anticipated that share and number of people will grow and new people will come in on board. So this is a totally new context within which you will have to fashion out our policies. On the other hand, what is also important is to note the impact of the COVID had been disproportionately on the traditionally non-poor or the more vulnerable people. So that this disaggregated approach, which SDG propagates, leave no one behind, has become much more relevant in the post-COVID circumstances. This is a bit of a taxonomy of the new situation which we have in which we approach the poor people on that. The important part over here is that there are a number of areas where the policy intervention as envisaged under the SDG 1 has become more important. Possibly the most important policy intervention which has become more important under SDG 1 is 1.3. It is the social protection issue. The social protection has become the critical intervention, and what we have seen from experience that the fiscal space for many of this country has not been adequate to finance the necessary level of social protection or targeted intervention which incentives which are needed to be provided. I think this is the key issue in SDG 1 at this moment. Having said that, I think we will be failing in our duty if we do not underscore the linkages or the trade-offs or the synergies, more particularly trade-offs in these cases we don't want to see. So obviously the first one is the health issue. You have a look at the SDG 1, you will see there are many types of disaster has been mentioned, from climate to natural disaster to various, but there is no health disaster issue. When we wrote the SDG 1, I think we never anticipated a pandemic of that order will come in as a disaster. And it was not anticipated over there. So that has to be, a health issue has come in. We know that what are the health issues over here. I don't have to tell this audience about that. Education has become more critical, particularly for getting back the children into school, the lost years of education and the dropouts. And this has affected the LNOB once again, left behind people. So the disaggregated approach, both on health and education, has become very, very critical. I think the equality, the SDG 8 is critical. Because we need to get back the employment and income over there. And I want to highlight, I underscore two particular targets over here, 8.5, which talks about the left behind people to get back to their work, and 8.7, which is very important as migrant workers for the developing countries, because migrant workers' remittances plays a big role in these cases. I think number 10, the inequality issue has become critically important, because in most countries, because of the COVID, not only the poverty has gone up, the inequality has deepened. Inequality not in terms of income only, but also in terms of assets and also consumption over there. I would like to conclude by saying that during this COVID period, not everything was so, the initial speakers mentioned not only to be, not to be only despondent, but also highlight some of the success areas. I want to bring to you two success areas in this case. The first one is 13.B. It is in the, 3.B in health, where the issues of vaccine has been mentioned. And I think the vaccine as a new global public good has emerged and has is a new response of the society, collective response to this pandemic. I think this has to be celebrated, but much more to be celebrated is 9.7. It is the digitization which has taken place in all over the world during this period, including in the developing countries and low-income countries, LDCs, that this digitization, particularly in the vaccination process, has really leapfrogged like anything. And we have seen that income sometimes is not necessarily a barrier in terms of digital progress as we go. This is something which has to be celebrated and we need to take it forward. My general point is that I think post-COVID scenario, what we need to do, focus on is, of course, along with that, the new focusing on the disaggregated approach to the left behind people, the new poor and the hardcore poor. But at the same time, we'll have to seek new partnership because all this need money. And when we need money, and whether this is a money with the private sector, I don't see much to come. It is the public resources which has to play the role. The traditional development finance has to, external development finance has to play the role. And obviously, each of the countries have to do their domestic resource mobilization. I think we are approaching possibly one of the most challenging years of the 15 year period of SDGs in the coming. I hope our joint wisdom will be good enough to confront it. Thank you for this webinar towards that end.
Thank you very much, Deb, especially for your insights on the importance of a disaggregated approach for vulnerable groups and the critical role that social protection and partnerships can play in transformative action and as a way to account for as well as your comments on the importance of the linkages with SDGs 3, 8, 9, and 10. Okay, so I'd like to now pass the floor to Chanteline and Chanteline Carpentier. Chanteline, in light of your dedicated interests in new economic models for sustainable development and partnerships to leverage sustainable recoveries, we would love to hear your thoughts on the role of trade and the private sector in accelerating implementation.
Thank you so much, and good morning, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for Stakeholder Forum for inviting me. I want to take this exactly where Dr. Batavcham left it. And one of the things that we did not include enough in the SDGs and the 2030 agenda is resilience. And you will have seen that the Secretary General has been talking about the perfect storm of cascading crisis. We have the COVID-19 coming on the hill of climate change, which is creating a cost of living crisis because our supply chains are being disrupted. And that is actually increasing poverty and hunger at alarming speed. And so the question is, and one of the things I want to mention before going into what you've been asking me to do in terms of solution is, we're now facing, if we don't get the fertilizers to farmers in Africa, it's no longer going to be just a crisis of affordability. It's going to be a crisis of availability. So one of the bright spot out there is that despite the war, despite the crisis that we're facing, we've managed to get the UN-backed Black Sea Grain Initiative, where we've been able to get tons of grain out of Ukraine and Russia, which means that because we can't address these issues only on the humanitarian side. Of course, the World Food Program needs to be there and help with true humanitarian, but the only way we're going to help all these people to reduce hunger and poverty is through the markets. So let me move to the market, which you talked about. So how do we increase resilience? One of the things that we at UNCTAD have always been saying is that it depends on achieving the SDG will depend on means of implementation. But there's means of implementation and means of implementation, and trade and investment are two of them. But trade and investment and markets, in what way? And so what we're finding is that because of the interlinkages that we're facing in the market right now, we need to have built-in resilience and built-in inclusivity in the markets that we have. What does that mean? Well, with the current mainstream economic model that we have, we pretty much can achieve, and Jamil alluded to that, SDG 1 through 9 at the expense of SDG 10 to 16. It's not going to work. We know it. So what are the alternatives that we may have? And I'm very happy to say that the UN Task Force on Social Solidarity Economy is working with several countries, including Spain and France and Senegal and Chile, to bring a resolution at the UN on the social and solidarity economy. Why? Because those have built-in inclusivity. They're not maximizing profit at the expense of people and planet. They are maximizing revenues, people, and planet at the same time. And these are the type of model that we need. We also need new trade and investment regime that will actually be in support of the SDGs and just decarbonization of the market, as well as an investment regime that is in support of that. You will all know that in addition to the Black Sea Initiative, we are working also with DESA and UNDP on the international financial architecture that would actually be conducive to achieving the SDGs. We saw that during the COVID-19, what happened is developing countries got had to borrow to support their population. Now they're at high risk of defaulting. They don't have the money that they need to invest in the SDGs. And therefore, we need new models to, otherwise, what's the alternative? Austerity. Well, austerity is actually the worst thing that we can do at this time, because austerity is the opposite of social protection. And it hurts the poor and women and the youngest the most. And therefore, what we need is not austerity, it's investment. But these developing countries do not have the fiscal space right now to invest in their education, their health system, as well as in their agriculture, which they've been dismantling for decades at the recommendation of developed countries like ours, to basically rely on the international market, which we see that now is creating a lot of vulnerability. So what we do need to do is to add to our equation revenues, people, planet, and resilience. So what can be done? One is reduce global food price disruptions, reduce the prices, and address supply disruption. Today, we released the review of maritime transport, where we're looking at these disruptions and what needs to be done. So I invite you to look at the briefing that will be given today, but also to support the Black Sea Initiative, because that's the way you can actually systemically reduce the price of fertilizers, the price of grain, so people can actually feed themselves. We also need to provide developing countries with the fiscal space and the financial resources to address the crisis. UNCTAD and the Secretary General have been asking for, and we ask for your support, that to reinstating the debt services suspension initiative, greater effort to rechannel unused special drawing rights at the IMF, and as I mentioned, a new international debt architecture as well. These are some of the best measures to reduce both, to advance and further SDG 1 and 2. And in concluding, we need to do these things, addressing short-term crisis, but not at the expenses of long-term. So the investment that we're making in agriculture now in developing countries, so they can increase, reduce their resilience and dependency on complex long supply chain, need to be in sustainable agriculture, decarbonized agriculture, and as well as investment in their renewable energy, so that they can actually build their economy of the future through green, circular, a purple, orange, and social solidarity economies. Over to you.
Many thanks, Chanteline. Thanks for these very important insights, especially for highlighting the role that market-based solutions could play in counteracting current and future crises, and the importance also of balancing the three P's to achieve an integrated approach, as well as building in inclusivity and resilience in these actions. Okay, I will now give the floor to Eunice Ajambo. Eunice, in the context of your very considerable experience working on the MDGs and involvements with UNECA and the Resident Coordinator's Office in Namibia, as well as your knowledge of African leadership, we look forward to hearing your recommendations.
Thank you, Dr. Horan, for the opportunity. Good morning, good afternoon, colleagues. I just wanted to start with a statement that poor people spend most of their income on food, and poor people earn majority of their income from the agricultural sector. I am sitting in a country whereby this fact is just becoming more of a priority in the policy space of economic transformation that is required to accelerate the achievement of the SDGs. So the fact that agriculture, 70% of the population in Namibia relies on the agricultural sector for employment, for their livelihoods, and this sector employs an estimated 32% as well. So this is an important fact, because initially the majority of the country's GDP has come from mining and natural resources extraction. It is only now within the current policy space that the government and the stakeholders are realizing and accepting that agriculture has to be a priority for the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals, and more importantly, to addressing the persistent challenge of poverty and inequality. So that is sort of the context we are in, whereby this sector, the unfinished business of the SDGs, of the MDGs, SDG 1 and SDG 2, are just become that interlinkage is being made as a priority right now. So in concrete terms, what does this then mean for the United Nations or the country level with the support that we provide to the government now that agriculture is a tool for poverty eradication? What is it we're doing to support this initiative? The first of it is in the analytics. For an upper middle income country where the data and the numbers have to count, the policymakers want to know the evidence of the synergies, of the trade-offs, and of the interlinkages. So what we are doing is a significant amount of policy analysis options. We are using tools, including the climate, land, and energy and water systems are tools, so CLUES. So CLUES is a tool that can help us to inform the government on the trade-offs of climate, land, energy, and water systems. And our preliminary analysis right now is actually indicating that the agriculture sector in the country has not even reached the potential that it could. So with that data and information, then we can advocate for the strengthening of the agriculture sector. And through that advocacy, we are also calling for the utilization of instruments such as technology to modernize and to strengthen the sector. The other tool that we use significantly and which helps us understand the linkage between SDG 1 and 2 is the IPC Acute Food Security Classification. So what that shows us, for example, is the drivers of food insecurity. And one of them that keeps emerging is the drought within the country, is the market accessibility as well. So with these two tools, the IPC and the CLUES, then we have the evidence and sort of the evidence base that we can use to advocate to government. In addition to sort of that evidence base is basically the issue of data. There's no way within the rooms of government where we're telling the story for agriculture, for economic transformation without the data. A very good example of this is the Namibia Livestock Identification and Traceability System. It's the NAMLITS. So NAMLITS helps us to understand basically the location of livestock within the country and the ownership of it, and then supporting the improvement of its quality for export. So that is sort of the evidence base for policy analysis. And then again, within the context of the food, energy, and the finance crisis emanating from the Russia-Ukraine crisis is the program interventions that we are sort of supporting. And these take two stances. The first one is the short term. So basically the short term emergencies that are needed, the social safety nets, the social protection that is required to ensure that sort of this shortfall in agriculture does not contribute further to poverty amongst the vulnerable or populations. So concretely, we have an example of WFP's homegrown school feeding program. This is a program that we are using as a short-term measure sort of to ensure that poor people and marginalized and vulnerable people are not going back into poverty. And then for the longer term sort of program intervention, we have FAO's Crise de Resilience approach. So it's the CDR approach. And this one sort of has a long-term aspect to it because it engages communities and going beyond just delivering of emergency aid, but contributing to the strengthening of the food systems, of the agro-systems value chain within the community. So we have, from a program intervention standpoint, both short-term and long-term. And I think Professor Dev mentioned the financing aspect. The evidence is showing indeed that access to finance, especially for poor people, and acknowledging that in most poor countries, the agriculture sector is full of poor people, and these poor people are the ones who don't have access easily to financing. Within the country team, we have what we call the Integrated National Financing Framework. In our case, we are also including a food systems aspect to these discussions on where are the different sources of financing with the country, within the country, and how can they be allocated. So within that INFF framework, we are figuring out, we are trying to find out how to crowd in more financing into the agriculture sector. The other one, which I would call a transformative institution, is the Agriculture Development Fund. And this is coming from the Malabo Declaration. Again, the importance of sort of those regional bodies, such as the African Union, advocating for agricultural development. So the Agriculture Development Fund within the country is being utilized to sort of catalyze the National Agriculture Investment Fund. And this is just the crowding in up and financing towards the sector. And I thought that
Thank you, Eunice. Your line is you're getting your connection is breaking there on us. But I'm also conscious that we're running short on time, and you've given us many great examples of various transformative actions that we can take, in particular the role that data can play in planning for transformation, and how the agricultural sector could be a tool for poverty eradication. And I particularly liked what you said about technical help from the UN helping to identify synergies and trade-offs, and how we can use that type of evidence then to advocate for strengthening solutions that really address these interlinkages, and through that then help to divert resources. Okay, so with that, I'll move on to, I'd like to give the floor to Dr. Daniel Malerba. Daniel, given your research on the links between poverty, climate, and social protection, as well as your forthcoming book with co-authors on governing the interlinkages between SDGs, approaches, challenges, and opportunities, we would love to hear your thoughts on ways to account for interlinkages when implementing SDG 1.
Yes, thank you, David, for the introduction and invitation. It's really an honor to be part of such important conversation. So because of time constraints, I would like to go directly to five main recommendations I would like to share with all of you. Three of them come from the book that you just mentioned, and two of them come from research on poverty and climate change. So in terms of the book deals with the issue of governing the SDG, and it basically looks at three different problems when we look at governance of the SDG. And I would like to give one recommendation, one reflection for each of these topics. So the first topic that we look at in the book is at what governance mechanisms and policies processes help to promote an inclusive and coherent governance of the SDG interlinkages. And not just for SDG 1, but for all the SDG, what is the main message that we find is that it is very much critical to better involve the local level. We did a scoping review of 137 BNRs and the SDG bodies, and what we find is that while horizontal integration is quite good in many countries, we find that vertical integration is quite insufficient in most countries. What we find is that, in fact, some national governments are not formally represented in many SDG coordination bodies, and if they are, they are just involved temporarily. And we actually also confirmed this finding also in some field research that we did for the book, where we actually find quite consistently that at the lower level, so what we can call working level, the knowledge about the SDGs is quite limited. So the first message is very critical to better involve the local level. The second theme that we look in terms of governing the SDGs is about the political institutional preconditions that help effective governance of the SDGs. In this case, we actually focus on SDG 1. And we do a systematic literature review of articles that were published in the last 6 to 10 years. And what we find is an incredible robust evidence that the characteristic of good governance governance that are part of the SDG 16. So for example, transparency, accountability, or also inclusive participation have a very much strong contribution towards poverty reduction, but also inequality reduction. And some cases that we found particularly interesting are, for example, electoral accountability, which improves effectiveness of social protection programs, and in return also poverty and inequality reduction. So here, in terms of political institutional preconditions, my second recommendation would be that it's very important to look at how these broad governance issues actually affect poverty and inequality. Now, a sort of recommendation 2.B would be that these institutional preconditions also affect the choice of the governance mechanism for the SDG implementation that I referred as in the first point. And in the book, we present research on, for example, sustainable water governance in Ethiopia, but also agri-food sector in South America, in different South American countries. And what we find is, for example, that hierarchical and not inclusive decision-making processes, which are quite linked to autocratic regimes and deficient democracies, actually tend to favor other SDGs like SDG 8 through industrial and commercial agriculture-led economic growth at the detriment of the SDGs that we are discussing today, such as SDG 1 and SDG 2. So my message 2.B would be that actually governance mechanism and institutional political institutional preconditions are quite linked. The third theme that we cover in the book is about policy mixes. And here I would like to link to what has been said in previous presentation, that the main message here is that in any policy mix that involves poverty, social protection is critical. Now, we know from the ILO report that half of the global population is not covered by social protection instruments, but also what I find quite challenging and hard to digest is that in recent reports it has been shown how actually the poor are not just not covered by a social protection instrument, but they're actually net contributor to the through the fiscal system because they pay indirect consumption taxes, but they do not receive anything out of the system. So it's very important to make fiscal system and social protection system very much in line with our SDG goals. And even though we have seen that in COVID, we can actually expand social protection system, many countries miss what we call, some of us call the digital backbone, so sort of the infrastructure to improve social protection systems. So these are the three main messages I would like to give from the book. And now I would just, to conclude, give two messages that look at the links between climate and poverty, so SDG 1 as the focus of today. So one is about still social protection, and social protection is not just important for poverty reduction, but is also critical when we link poverty reduction to climate change. And we can see that both in the narrative of the just transition movement, but also in the current climate and energy crisis that we're witnessing at the moment. For example, we're doing a study that looks at the global level. So we consider around 200 countries, and we can see that carbon taxes and revenue redistribution through social protection can actually lower poverty by between 100 and 200 million people. So in a way, carbon taxes can create the fiscal space, as some of you was mentioning before, but then it really much depends on how we redistribute the revenue through social protection. And even international transfer between countries can make this redistribution effect even much stronger. And my last message linked to climate and poverty is about the SDGs and their kind of clarification needs. So for example, if we look at SDGs, we have SDG 1.1, which is an absolute measure of poverty, while if we look at SDG 1.2, considers national measures of poverty, which for high level country, for most of them, it equals to a redistribution measure. And if we look also at SDG 10, we have a mix because we have SDG 10.1, which looks at growth rates for different sector of the population, and indicator 10.4.2, which looks at the Gini index. So again, redistribution. And for me, it's very important that we clarify this. And then as if we frame poverty reduction as an inequality reduction or as an economic growth target, has very much strong implication with climate and the role of social protection. And this has to especially consider the fact that there are many differences between higher and lower income countries, with the latter countries probably having already enough resources for poverty eradication. I think I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Daniel, especially so many insights there, especially for drawing attention to the important element of vertical linkages and interactions, and also interactions across countries. I especially liked your recommendation on giving voice to local communities and policy decisions, as well as your insight that the actual government mechanisms that we use can bias what types of linkages we actually consider in policy processes. So that's something I haven't heard before, and I think it's important to get that idea out there. I look forward to reading the book when it's published in December. Okay, so I now give the floor to Hannah El-Hilali. Hannah, in light of your vast experience as the former acting manager, director of the Social Fund for Development, and leadership roles in the areas of microfinance, SMEs, and asset management for sustainable development, we would be delighted to hear your recommendation.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you very much, Charles, and my best regards to all the speakers, distinguished speakers. Actually, we're touching base on a subject that's very close to my heart. SMEs and microfinance are a main tool for poverty eradication. And when we prioritize on the actions on poverty eradication, this includes improving access to sustainable livelihoods. And we need to address this on grassroots levels. Also the entrepreneurial opportunities and productive resources, providing universal access to basic social services, social safety nets and subsidies. And we need to capitalize on the role of intermediaries, since NGOs are a very important tool to access, to assess and access the poor community and provide the services required, be it illiteracy, be it health, financial inclusion, awareness and practice, fintech, because nowadays we're applying fintech in microfinance. I mean, we're trying to establish the awareness and culture of the poor people using sort of mobile phones, applications, and so on and so forth, to have access to their loans and also to repay their loans. We are also using intermediaries such as the post office for this function as well. But we still need to establish awareness and culture in this regard. Also providing universal access to basic social services, empowering people living in poverty and their organizations, addressing the disproportionate impact of poverty on women. And as we see, the interlinkages between pillar number one, no poverty, and the other SDGs pillars, we see hunger, we see women empowerment, we see good health, education, gender equality, clean water. I mean, it's all co-linked and very important. So we need to address each one of those pillars and link them to the poverty aspect and to microfinance where it can help. It's not just microfinance, but microfinance and small and medium enterprises as well, because they act as tools for change in creating jobs, in alleviating poverty, and in providing services for the poor. We need to address the disproportionate impact on poverty on women, and I'm a big advocate on women empowerment and women economic empowerment, which leads to social empowerment as well. We work with very important donors, interested donors, and recipients who are really keen on providing the funding. And this is a very important role that the donors should play. And this is a recommendation that should be enhanced in order to alleviate poverty and provide access to finance for the poor. Also the shares of ODA to poverty eradication and intensifying the international cooperation for poverty eradication as well. if we have sort of the pinpointing and highlighting hindrances and biggest barriers and challenges and risks to implement and accelerate implementation for the poverty aspect. Access to land is a main issue. Traditional socio-political power-led culture. We're talking here about big landowners, men-led culture, climate change, natural resources, and environmental-related challenges. We, in Egypt, just had the COP27 conference, and it was very important to pinpoint and highlight the environmental aspects in microfinance and in small and medium enterprises. And we have a very, very interesting projects that are in the pipeline. We also talk about water, about energy, about natural disasters that could affect the poor, and how could governments react, about climate change, and we all know about the global crisis that we are all facing in this regard. Political structures, scientific skills and training are quite interesting that required to educate the poor. Negotiation skills and access to finance, because those poor people are helpless. They don't have access to banks, to financial institutions. So what really helps is the newly established MFIs or the microfinance institutions, where the poor can have access to finance for very, very small portions of loans, like £2,000 Egyptian pounds. I mean, less than $1,000 actually. And they can have the access to the loans, get the loans approved in between 1 to 4 days, have venues to repay, as I mentioned earlier, the post office, the NGOs, and the banks. We have also highlighted the lack of reliable and fair market rates, and undefined supply and value chains are very important as well. However, we need to establish awareness when it comes to financial inclusion and FinTech, because we're currently using the FinTech process. We need to transform the informal sector to formal to reflect on GDP, but this requires a lot of incentives that could be given to the poor to be transformed from the informal to the formal. They would not transform unless they get a good portion of incentives. We need to provide for, and I strongly believe in this, a microfinance integrated package that includes microcredit, microhealth, micro savings, and micro insurance. So this is a new product that needs to be further developed and further enhanced. And we need to design microfinance projects targeting women and youth community, and also to include the underprivileged and special needs, and also individuals in rural to finance to have to provide for access to finance. If we're talking about...
Thank you, Hannah. I think you're having problems with your connection.
...of action and an action roadmap. Am I? Can you hear me now?
You're coming across a little bit muffled, and I'm also just conscious we're running short on time. But you've been very comprehensive, and thanks for your valuable insights. I especially like how you look at a sustainable development challenge like poverty eradication and its multidimensional aspects. And from that perspective, then develop a public and private financial strategy, as well as policy incentives to really address the problem in all those aspects. Okay, thank you very much to all the speakers. I will now, in the limited time we have remaining, open the floor to questions and answers. If Charles, if you think we have time for that.
Well, I'm just jumping in now to say, for those, we were meant to just finish up the top of the hour. For our guests, if you're able to stick with us just for a few minutes, that would be great. If you cannot, we fully understand that. Also to say that young Gustav and to Jamil and Fred, if you'd like to activate your cameras and jump in, you're very welcome to. There are a number of questions, quite a few. And I'm thinking I would recommend that maybe we just focus on those that are specific to SDG 1 and 2. So for example, there was a question to Yunis, which states, along with food security, what is our plan to bring focus to nutritional security, especially with reference to stunted child growth? So those are sort of questions maybe we can address in the short time we have. Yunis, over to you.
Very quick, thank you. On nutritional security, actually what we're finding is the importance of local knowledge and culture when it comes to the foods that we consume. So where I'm sitting now, and this applies to the point of market access, 60% of the food that comes into the country is imported. So by the time it gets here, I'm sure you can imagine the loss of nutritional value. So what we're advocating for now, again, not to do away with the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, but to support more of the local foods that are grown locally and are more nutritious and retain the nutritional value that we require. Thank you for the question, and over.
Thank you, Eunice. I also, if you don't mind, to our panelists, you have access to the Q&A. If you see something that you'd like to address, just, you know, put your hand up and please do. But in the meantime, this might be for Chandeline. It says, since we have policies for green jobs taking priority, what plan can be towards, and Hana as well, what plan can we roll towards micro business towards green jobs? If we can bring micro business with self-help groups, joint liability groups into focus with the help of the ILO, do we have some strategies for micro and small green businesses?
Yeah, maybe I start and then I can complete because I'm sure we're going to go in the same direction because I agree with her presentation. I do believe the entrepreneurs and MSMEs are the key to achieving the SDGs, and especially if we empower women. And I like the specific institution, like market-like approach that Anna proposed. We're working now on, you know, if we could, we did not support MSMEs during the financial crisis, 2007-2008. We supported them during COVID-19. If we could align that support to the SDGs, they could be the agent of change to achieve, because many of the multinationals, it's very hard for them to go and reach the last mile. And many of these problems we're having is last mile. So how do we empower these MSMEs and these entrepreneurs to help us achieve the SDGs? First is awareness. Second is providing them the technical capacity to do it and the support to do it, including these insurance schemes, these programs dedicated to women, but also just the capacity to use circular economy, to use the alternative economic models, such as the social solidarity economy type model, cooperatives, and employee-owned companies that are more inclusive to start with. But Anna, I'll let you come in.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dia. This is very important. As I mentioned, we just ended the COP27 with a lot of projects that relate to this aspect in the pipeline. So feasibility studies need to be there. Awareness should be there. Access to finance should be there. Cooperatives, I mean, the link with cooperatives is very important. And also the items and the facilities related to SMEs and microfinance should be provided as well. I mean, like capacity building, like training, like awareness through the media, a lot must be done there, because this is only the start. We had all seen how important this is to the world. Not just to Egypt, but microfinance and small and medium enterprises can play a very important role. And with the Social Fund for Development financing these projects with banks, because now banks in Egypt, financial institutions in Egypt, are also financing the small and micro and medium enterprises. And this is a mandate of the Central Bank of Egypt, mandating the banks to provide for 25% of the loan portfolio to SMEs. So this is no joke. I mean, they have to abide with it. NGOs also play a very important part in also financing very, very small projects in this. And I think the awareness is there, the willingness is there. The government also should include this in the strategy to implement and to promote as well, because this has a very good payback effect, not only on the community, but also on raising the standards of living and income of the poor.
Thank you, Chantaline and Hannah. Jan Gustav, I see you have your hand raised.
I was just going to say very quickly, maybe then the MSMEs should also have access to the funds that are acquired through the loss and damages agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan Gustav. David, have you identified a question that we might want to answer in the short time that we have left?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was an excellent result of the COP27.
Thanks, Charles. And I think that was Anna as well. There was one question. It's a very simple question. It was asked by Ma'am Alifer. It was the first question in the thread. She says, I'm wondering what concrete steps can be taken for the SDGs to become a reality to improve living conditions of people at the grassroots and not feel like the MDGs that did not achieve the aim for which they were set up. So I think in the context that we're at the midpoint, to me the real value of the SDG framework is that we can think holistically about issues. And I think today we heard a lot of interesting approaches to trying to do that. And as Fred was saying at the outset, we don't sometimes discuss these interlinkages enough. And I think now is an opportunity to really bring that to the forefront. So if maybe a quick roundtable before we wrap up, Charles, of just 30 seconds, what your main recommendation would be to really drive, based on all your vast experiences, to really drive progress in the second half of the implementation.
Well, certainly. Thank you, David. I would then say if I would be happy to give each of our speakers, if they'd like, you know, a quick comment. Deb, you're the first one on my screen. You got your hand raised if you'd like to make a comment.
Again, I go back. I fall back on the COVID issue. I think the COVID had been a great revealer for many of us regarding the challenges, the traditional challenges and the new challenges we are confronting at this point. So the one of the major issues which I pick up from my fellow panelists as well is that the governance issue has not been adequately addressed in earlier occasions. And if you look at the VNRs also, which essentially, if you allow me my immodesty to express that it turns out to be a beauty parade, every country trying to show off what they have done, which not necessarily always substantiated by realities on the ground. The issue is that we never really brought in the hard issue of both the squeezing political space for the civil society, who was a major partner for delivering SDGs in their respective countries. So I think the governance issue should get some prominence, particularly in terms of distribution of social protection and access to quality education and health services. I think all these have been revealed by the COVID, like anything in each of our countries. This is one. The other point is, again, I hammer on the disaggregation part and the localization of the SDG issues, and also in terms of resource mobilization and citizens' participation in that case. I think these are the two extremes. And of course, the third one is the partnership issue, the global part. So global partnership, national governance, and localization of the SDGs. These are the three major institutional, I think, the hot points I would like to underscore at the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deb. Chantaline, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I just wanted 2 points. First, let's not accept this dichotomy that we've been told. There are trade-offs between the SDGs right now because of the assumed economic model and financial model that we have. We can address most of these trade-offs with right data and with the right economic and financial model. Second, do not accept also the dichotomy that you've been imposed, and please do put pressure, especially American and those in developed countries, about the only solution that we have is to increase interest rate to control the inflation. 50% of the inflation is caused by the supply side. We've documented that. We need to address the supply side as well. And so please put pressure, because once we increase these interest rates, every 1% increase in interest rate by the central bank is leading to 0.7% decrease in GDP in developing countries. That's a direct relationship. That's from the Fed's model. We need to put some pressure here so that we do not use one tool in all toolbox.
Thank you, Gentiline. That's such an excellent intervention. Hannah, you have your hand up.
Yes, please. Thank you very much. We need to ensure significant mobilization of resources from a variety of sources, and namely two LDCs in particular. We need to create sound policy frameworks at the national, regional, and international levels based on, and this is very important, pro-poor and gender-sensitive development strategies to support accelerated investment in poverty eradication actions. So if we do that, I think we'll be in good shape.
Thank you, Hannah. Daniela, would you care to say last comment?
Yeah, I would like just to kind of also underline the importance of the local context. There has been some research and a book launched by Frank Biermann and colleagues who recently basically showed how the SDGs run the risk of being an empty box. And I really think that connecting more the SDGs to the local context can sort of fill this box and make the SDGs closer to it, their goals and implementation.
Thank you, Danielle. Eunice, you have the floor if you wish.
National development plans and strategies. Those are the entry points for action at the national level, because that's also how financing and resources are allocated. Multi-stakeholder engagement, and particularly for this topic today, mainstreaming the food systems approach and pathways to development. Thank you, and over.
Thank you, Eunice. Fred, would you care to say a few words?
Yes, I think one, at the local context, we see a lot of excitement in these so-called voluntary local reviews. We know the national reviews perhaps have some shortcomings, although they're very important. Second point, I think change often comes from the periphery. You know, we need to look and find those change, those examples. So that it's there. But we need to decenter our usual subjects, perhaps the government, perhaps, state, and look where is that change coming from and that transformation. It is there. Transformation is always happening. You know, our nature of the human endeavor is change. It is ingenuity. We're probably going to muddle through, but we need to find those examples of change and bring and use those fora like the SDG Summit, like this event, to put them front and center and share them. Over. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Jan Gustav, would you care to say a final word?
Well, thank you very much, Charles. I would just say that we need to raise our ambitions and expectations for the SDG summit and not let pessimists dominate this. And I would also thank Dr. Bhattacharya for saying that governance needs to be a very clear mainstay. Civil society need to be brought in, and they're now threatened all over the world. Localizing the SDGs is important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Angus. Hannah, you have your hand up again. Did you want to make another comment?
Yes. Yes, a final comment, please. New partnerships also must be extended to universities and schools to enhance the curricula to reflect the sustainable development goals. We need to establish this awareness amongst universities and schools and so on and so forth, and even the civil society, NGOs, and so on. And also governments to accelerate progress at all levels by fully leveraging the civil society, NGOs. Thank you.
David, I'd like to give you the last word before I do the final wrap up. So David, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Charles. I just want to express a big thanks to everyone for participating in the discussion today. I think it was very fruitful. While everybody recognizes the difficulties in enabling integrated approaches, I think we have today highlighted some concrete steps that could be taken in this direction. Many thanks for that, and I'll hand it over now to Charles for closing.
Thank you, David, and especially thank you to Jan Gustav, who is working with us at Stakeholder Forum for so many years, our colleagues at UNDESA and UNEP, and in particular, a huge thanks to our expert panel for delivering today's rich and thoughtful content. As mentioned earlier, the webinar has been recorded, and that recording will be posted as a video and also as an audio podcast on the Stakeholder Forum website very soon. In addition, the Stakeholder Forum team will prepare a summary of this and future webinars for input into the United Nations SDG Summit 2023. Lastly, I do hope you'll join us on December 4th for the second in this series of Countdown to the UN SDG Summit 2023 webinars. We will highlight SDGs 3 and 4, good health and well-being, and quality education. We'll certainly be sending out joining instructions soon. Until then, thank you ever so much to all of you. Good health to you all, and goodbye.